Lion and special guests Freedom Nsoroma Lee L. Proceeds to benefit WPFW. Details WPFWFM.org.
Do you love WPFW? Now is your chance to get involved by participating in the local station board. Run for a seat on the board by becoming a candidate between June 1st and June 30th. Complete your candidate package located on elections.pacifica.org. Call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor.
I don't know whether he wants me to begin the show. Okay. Should I begin the show? Or wait, should I wait?
So speak.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Karen Uten. Karen Uten is the author of Dixon Descendant, a novel published by Dutton. Karen Dutton received an MFA. Let me go over this again because I got, okay. Let me stop right there because this is more important. I'm not recording, so I can now.
Okay. Recording in progress.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Karen Uten. Karen Uten is the author of Dixon Descending, a novel published by Dutton. Karen Uten is received an MFA from the University of Michigan. How are you doing today, Karen?
I'm well, thank you.
Okay, well, you know, I last saw you back on February 6th at Politics and Prose.
Mm-hmm.
You gave a wonderful discussion of how you wrote Dixon Descending, and so I want to continue that discussion.
Wonderful.
So let's begin with your two main characters, Nate and Dixon Bryant. Two Black men who decide to climb Mount Everest. How are these brothers different? What motivates them? And what is their relationship with their parents?
Oh, great question. I think what motivates them is ego, first of all. But also, I think of them as men who are driven to do an audacious thing. I think that Nate and Dixon have a loving rivalry, and they each have something different to prove in doing this and in promoting and pushing each other to do this. So they have motives not just for themselves, but for each other. You know, this is what I want my brother to do because I want to show him, I want to see him succeed in this way. I want him to see this about himself. And so I think that is a lot of what plays out. And birth order plays out also, because Nate is the older brother. He's very charming. Things have come relatively easily to him in many ways, but he's also been miscast, I think, because of that. Because of that, that's what people expect of him. So there is, his brother Dixon believes there's more to him than that. And I think that's part of what he wants to come out in this climb. And on Dixon's part, on Nate's part, Nate as the older brother, he knows that Dixon has been the good one. He's been the good boy who's done everything that's expected of him. but he wants him to step out of that box just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this trip to Everest is a chance for both of them to redeem each other in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say this, I mean, this is fiction, but mm-hmm. I'm just wondering whether as you're writing this novel, you're drawing upon cousins, people that you know, your family, and say, yeah, I'm going to weave. They may not know it, but I'm going to weave them into this character. Did any of that happening here?
Well, you know, it's funny because my cousins have been sort of secretly emailing me and saying, I know this is about so-and-so. I know this is such and such. And I have to say that this is not a knowingly biographical novel. What I did draw on, I mean, I think the surprise for me was that I was writing primarily about men and their relationships. Mm-hmm. And once I understood, you know, this is really a story about these Black men and who they are with each other and what their responsibilities are to each other, both in terms of this sibling relationship, but in a larger sense, their relationships to other people they are involved with in the novel. I did feel this high level of responsibility to try to get it right. So what I did draw on from family is I have a large extended family, and I thought a lot about my boy cousins, as we call them, you know, who are all grown men. But I thought about their relationships, and then I did things like call them up and ask them questions that they had to, you know, give me a long story on, or email them so that I could get a sense of their voices on the page, mm-hmm. and think about their relationships to one another. So in a general sense, that guided me, but I didn't model anyone after someone in particular.
Well, talking about getting the voices on the page, mm-hmm. if you could, for our listeners, read the first two pages of Dixon Descending.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And this takes place back in March 2011. That's the date that you have.
Yes, March 2011, Mount Everest. This first time, as they hoisted themselves onto the hip of the mountain, they had to simply learn to survive. Survive the landscape, the thin air, the unbelievable cold, the exquisite suffering. Each step of Dixon's crampons on ice was accompanied by a headache so intense he thought a tiny demon jabbed a pitchfork endlessly inside his ear. His stomach cramped. His tongue swelled against the roof of his dehydrated mouth. He inhaled heavily. At 18,000 feet and rising, his every breath was hard won, a perfect, exhilarating orb of suffering. His brother Nate climbed just in front of him along a narrow path that stretched between ice boulders. Nate looked back at him, panting lightly but smiling, his black goggles gleaming on his face rock star-like. Man, we're in rare air, Black men on Everest. Dixon repeated it with awe. Black men on Everest, which was to say freed men, because their burdens here were of their own making. Blue-white ice glowed above their heads. They were climbing just above base camp, deep in the Khumbu Icefall, a once cascading river frozen mid-flow. A surreal landscape of ice boulders at improbable angles perched along cliffs. The ground rumbled beneath their feet. It was a game of dodgeball, judging which boulder might tumble toward them. And this was only their first acclimatizing trip up the mountain. There would be three climbs, up ever higher, then back down, before they attempted the summit. Three more chances to lose this survival game, an improbable game growing ever more ridiculous, not just skimming boulders, but spanning crevasses so impossibly deep they might emerge on the other side of the earth. They had chosen this, Dixon reminded himself, and squinted into the glare ahead of him. A stunning flash, a warning flare. The sun bounced off the aluminum shell of a ladder, four ladders actually, lashed together and spanning a crevasse slit deep and jagged in the ice. And he was expected to cross it. Unfathomable, all of it, crevasses, ice blocks, mountains. A thrill seized his groin. He turned toward his loosely tethered band of 20 team members, Sherpas and guides, their red and blue and yellow down suits iridescent against the snow. Lunatics did this kind of thing. Lunatics and heroes, Dixon thought, laughing. And which did he think he was? Both, he said aloud.
You're listening to Karen Utin reading from her novel, Dixon, Descending. Karen, I found your book not just about two men climbing Mount Everest, but about the relationship between Black men and Black boys, our educational system, bullying, trauma, the juvenile justice system, as well as guilt. Talk about the reasons for writing this book with all these different dimensions.
This book appeared to me in a way that made me feel like it was a gift. I one day saw Dixon up in front of me. He was standing in front of his middle school where he worked as a school psychologist. And it was clear something had happened to him. He was gaunt. He was favoring one leg. His skin was damaged. And I thought, what in the world happened? And it sort of came to me that he'd been to Mount Everest. And I started thinking about aftermath and about what happened if you went to Mount Everest. It wasn't as you planned, because there's so much out there about triumph and even about tragedy on the mountain, but so little about what happens afterwards. And I started thinking about the whole of his life and how he was affected. And that is sort of the genesis for the, you know, what happens? How did he become what was clear to me, a broken man?
Well, take us back. What happened in 1996 on Mount Everest, and how did that incident influence you?
Yeah. 1996, the disaster on Mount Everest, I think, is what brought Mount Everest into the sort of public consciousness. Before that, I think most of us knew that fact that Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay had summited Mount Everest in 1953. And it was just a fact out there. I don't know that for the public consciousness, we thought that much about climbing. But in 96, there was that storm on Mount Everest. And it happened that John Krakauer was on that trip and he wrote the book Into Thin Air afterwards. There was, as it happened, an IMAX movie team there filming, and they filmed it, and it became the Everest IMAX movie. So suddenly, Everest comes into view. And I remember distinctly opening Newsweek magazine and seeing this map of the mountain and seeing the list of the people who had died in the storm and thinking, what is this? And then seeing the IMAX movie. And I think the question for me was, who does this? Especially once I saw the aluminum ladders strung together over those crevasses. I thought, you got to be kidding me. And even once I began writing the book, I think I was still in that head of, why does somebody do this? And it wasn't until I actually talked to a couple of climbers that I started to get it, which actually scared me a little bit because I thought, okay, now I understand why you do that.
Well, let's compare. Let's take what you just said and compare it to yourself, okay? Mm-hmm. What mountain did you have to climb to finish this book?
Oh, wow. The mountain of perseverance. This book, so I've been writing for about 40 years. I published my first short story in Essence magazine 40 years ago. And so I've written short stories and essays. I have sort of gone in and out of working full-time and working part-time and getting an MFA and teaching for a while, all trying to keep the writing at the forefront, which is no small thing to do over the course of a life. And I'm certainly not alone. And I had written a first novel, had an agent at the time who wasn't able to sell it. This was about 20 years ago. And it was such a process of grieving that not having happened. And that's why when Dixon appeared to me a couple of years later, it felt like, okay, is he going to be my gift? And over the course of writing this book, over 15 years, you know, I was working full time. So it took a long time. Every vacation, I went away to a different place to write, to a retreat. You know, writers never actually go on vacation. We just go someplace to write.
Right. Right.
And this book took about, I think there are 5 to 6 completely different versions of the book, especially the parts back on Earth, as I call it, as opposed to on the mountain, and various characters, until I could distill it down to what it was. And I think the book just had a lot to teach me along the way. And a lot of that was about writing about these Black men and their relationships to each other and to their larger community. And as you were saying, to the boys who were sort of in their care.
Well, you know, Karen Uten, the Olympics in Paris is beginning in July 26. You have Dixon, who is a person trying to compete to get to the Olympics.
Yes.
And he looks over and he fails by about a few seconds.
Yeah, 2/10.
2/10 of a second. There's probably many people that we're not going to see in Paris that will have experienced what you described in terms of Dixon's book. And I wonder what happens to that athlete who doesn't climb the mountain, but that who doesn't get to the Olympics, but now comes back and are they working in the gym or in the high school? You know, is this why he's a working at a school? But you know, it's a whole thing where you were seen as the best in your neighborhood, the best in your state, but that wasn't good enough to when you got to like the international level. Just talk about that, and then also look about that. In terms of, you mentioned in your first piece being an essence and things of that sort. I'm looking at writers who come really close.
Yes. Yes.
I almost made it to me. I was a runner-up.
Yeah, I could have been a contender. Right.
You know, so I know you got a Rocky story too. So
but
just talk about that. And in the context, I mean, where it seems if I was a coach right now, and somebody didn't make it to the Olympics, I'm giving them this book.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny because I have been watching the Olympic trials. And last night when I was watching, I kept focusing on number 5 and number 6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were saying the top 4 people will go or the top 2. What do you do if you're number 3 and you're that 2/10? And I couldn't help but focus on the face of that person and think about what is there left. Because you're right, you've been the best for so long and somebody suddenly beats you. And you know it's possible, you know this can happen. And there's a scene in the book where Dixon remembers that moment at the Olympic trials when he's running, and he starts to feel that heat and that speed of that person beside him coming up, and then another one. And there's nothing he can do. And he's trying to kick it into gear. He's trying to stay focused. He's trying not to cramp up, and it's passing him by. And he relives that a lot. I thought about that while I was, you know, it's really present, you know, during these Olympic trials. And I thought about that in terms of climbing the mountain when I was writing, and the business of what do you do when you go home? You keep reliving it. I'm sure you do. And the only thing I could find that was close to the experience of what happens after the mountain, whether you summit or whether you don't, you still done this amazing thing that few people have done. The closest thing I could come to it was the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, when it happened in 68, it was all triumph and look what they've done and their families are behind them and all of that. And now 50 years later, they're like, yeah, some of them came home pretty jacked up. Mm-hmm. There was depression. There was drinking. Some of the families fell apart. Afterwards, there was that feeling of what is there left for me? And I think that must be that feeling of having been in this extraordinary, and I use that word audacious again, having done this extraordinary thing that you expect to change your life in ways that maybe will be all positive, but maybe they're not. Or even if they are, you're someone different now.
You know, I'm glad you said that because you're examining African American men, and I'm looking at the stories that we don't fully get, and I'm just wondering. I mean, Willie Mays just died, and you know, everybody's talking about him saying "Say hey," and Willie always has a smile and stuff like that. But then I also look at, I go back to Jackie Robinson, and Jackie Robinson had a temper, you know, and people sometimes don't focus on the Jackie Robinson after Brant Rikki said the experiment's over, you know, because Jackie got into a whole bunch of fights, you know, stuff like that. He couldn't stand Roy Campanella for a while, you know what I mean? He did it on his own team, and you know, and I just wonder. And then I always talk about how his hair turned whiter, that he, you know, that all that rage and stuff. And I'm wondering in terms of, I mean, Willie Mays lived a long life, and I'm comparing Mays, I'm comparing Jackie Robinson. And I'm coming back to you, Karen Uten, because you are writing about these black men, but you're not a black man. But you must see it from a perspective where you see, you know, you could be the mother of some of these people, or the sister of some of these people. Or you could be Rachel Robinson.
I was surprised how deeply I was able to get into Dixon and how much I really love Dixon and Nate and Herbert and even Shiloh and Marcus, the kids. And I think two things helped me very much. One, as I said, talking to my cousins and my uncles on the phone and asking them questions. And the question that became sort of central to me is one I got from Roger Fairfax, who is outgoing dean of the law school at AU and is about to become dean of Howard Law. He was a professor at GW Law, where I work. And he was so gracious with his time. He took me out to lunch. I was like, maybe I could just talk to you for half an hour for about juvenile justice. He said, no, let's sit down, let's have a conversation. And we talked for a couple of hours, and he gave me some clues about juvenile justice, which were enough for me to know, okay, I can write around this subject. I can't get to, I don't know quite enough. But what he said that was so pivotal, and as we were just discussing Dixon and how he might feel about his responsibilities toward the young boys in his care, because he's a school psychologist at a charter school for boys. He said, you know, if he is aware and trying to be present, he will fall into one of two camps. And this is a debate that Black men often have among themselves. Do I help everybody regardless? Am I never going to give up on you? Or do I feel like there are so many people in need of my help that I help you until you show me that you don't want my help and then I move on? Which camp are you going to fall in? And that to me seemed such an enormous burden, but also a real test of how you're going to carry yourself in the world and who you're going to be. And as I started talking to my male cousins, I heard them echoing that in ways that I don't think I expected, especially those who were in positions either through their jobs or through some, you know, activity in their lives where they were dealing with young Black men a lot. There is this way in which you have to decide, how am I going to divide up my energy? Where am I going to place it? And that was a kind of a revelation to me. I'm sure that there are those choices that women must make also, but I looked at it in terms of the lens of who are these Black men, what makes them, and what then becomes their burden based on which thing they take on.
Well, you know, Karen Uten, many African American women writers over the years have focused on the telling the stories of Black women. In your book, Mount Everest is a woman. Why is this important?
Because what mountains are referred to as women, right? That's how the climbers refer to them. And because the Nepalese call her Shomolungma, which is Mother Goddess of the Earth. And that really appealed to me because I thought, you know, she's large and in charge. And the whole idea of conquering her is so misguided. And even Edmund Hillary said, you know, that he was asked, you know, how do you feel about conquering Mount Everest? And he said, I didn't conquer her. She relented. And I did feel this power from her, that it is definitely her choice whether or not she allows you to summit. And the Sherpas know that, and that's why one of the rituals at base camp is to ask her permission. Because if she doesn't want you there, forget it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk briefly about three women who are in your book.
Okay.
That's Kyra, Charlena.
Charlena, yes.
And Lena.
Yes.
So just give us a little bit of who are these three women?
Okay. Kyra is Dixon's daughter, who is about 19 years old and is in college and is, you know, searching for her identity in lots of ways and is a fan of her dad, but also, and of her uncle, but also just really wary about this business of them climbing because it's so dangerous and she's not sure what will happen. And she's also savvy enough to understand the relationship between her father and her brother, and to know that her father will do whatever her uncle Nate asks them to do. And she worries about whether or not that will put him in danger. Charlena is their cousin. And, you know, people always say, is that you? No, it's not. It's not me. But I certainly feel like Charlena is their sister cousin, because she grew up with them and she grew up sort of like a Wendy to their to their lost boys. You know, Dixon says she was always sort of at the head of the boat, shining the light, leading the way in lots of ways. And she's very fierce and loyal to both of them. Mm-hmm. And then there's Lena, who is a climber, an alpinist. They meet on the mountain and she gets involved with Nate and later is in contact with Dixon. And they have a strong friendship that Dixon, I think, would like to be more. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to mention those three female characters because I felt these three female characters overshadow a very important female character, and that is Dixon's wife, his ex-wife. Mm-hmm. Is that deliberate that they're divorced?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, I think it's deliberate in terms of where Dixon is in his life. Also, it probably made life a little easier for me because I didn't have to convince a spouse that, oh, gee, I'm going to go climb Mount Everest, honey, with all of our money, because this is an expensive proposition. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I think it was Jimmy Carter was going to climb a mountain. And I remember Rosalind Carter said, no, that's it, Jimmy. You do this one on your own.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And this and you know, his ex-wife, Pamela, even though they're divorced, she still gives him a hard time about climbing. Right. It takes him a minute to remember, wait a minute, I don't have to answer to her anymore.
But I just wonder also, is that because, quote, he like failed in his marriage, that she expects him to fail climbing the mountain, you know, is that also how she views him?
Oh, interesting. I had not thought about that. I mean, I think that her primary motivation is she's worried that something will happen to him or that he'll die and that her daughter will be left without a father because Pamela lost her father when she was young. And that, you know, that echoes me. I was 20 when my dad died. And it does change you, you know.
You see how we talk longer, we find you seeping into this book.
And... Yeah. Well, you know, it's in many ways, I am sure that this, even though this is about men, there is a way in which I suspect this is more autobiographical than any of the books that I've written before, or books, stories or anything, even though those stories were about women. And in fact, my mother says to me, you should read your book sometime. You're going to find a lot in it.
Mothers always say that. That's why I wrote
That's
poetry.
Right.
So my mother wouldn't be able to get into that. Well, look, Karen Uden, I found, and this is just my reading of your novel, I found that Marcus and Shiloh's stories at times overshadowed that of Nate and Dixon. Mm-hmm. Why is Dixon Bryant so concerned with both of these boys?
I think Dixon feels like
maybe just talk really, to explain to everyone who these two boys are.
So Dixon is a school psychologist, and these two boys are in his care in many ways. They're, you know, part of his caseload. Marcus is a really sweet boy, kind of vulnerable. And Shiloh is the bully who picks on him relentlessly and you know, pretty viciously. I think for Dixon, he has felt that he's the designated caretaker in lots of ways. Since the time he was a kid, he was the good boy, the one who had to look after his brother, who had to look after the other kids in the neighborhood. So it was sort of, that's the thing that was reinforced by his parents' friends. This is who you are. So he was given this identity that he embraces because he actually gets to shine a great deal. You know, when he walks down the hallway, he's a tall man. He's about 6'5". He walks down the hallway at school. He's always wearing a suit, you know, because that's who he is. So he has this presence. Mm. And he knows that that's important for those boys. And there are even a group of them, his co-workers joke that these are the acolytes who hang out around him and just want to be in his orbit. So he takes very seriously the fact that he's there for these boys. And it's pretty effortless and easy. And nothing challenges him in that role until Marcus and Shiloh come along. Mm. And, you know, it's funny because Shiloh was supposed to take up about a couple of pages, mm-hmm. and Shiloh would not go away from me. And I could not move forward in the story. I was stuck for a couple of months until I just relented. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to say, okay, you want to be here and you want to cause trouble, so I've got to let you. Mm. But it took a while to do that.
You know, I wanted to go back to, you were talking about, you were watching the Olympic trials.
Yes.
And I'm looking at the former athletes who come back to their hometowns, mm-hmm. In terms of what jobs they take. Mm. I know there's some jobs, you know, some people come back and they want to be a coach, you know, mm-hmm. that. But how important is it for Dixon to be a psychologist? Okay, because when I looked at that profession, I looked at the characters you develop, it seemed as if Dixon is more concerned with other people's problems than his own.
Mm-hmm. You know, with the few psychologists and psychiatrists that I know quite a few, and clinical social workers, that's often their MO. Mm-hmm. That I think part of what draws them to that is probably trying to understand themselves, but also whatever insight they have. But it's a profession that leads you to give more than to take. And so you're constantly thinking about other people in that way. And I think for Dixon, what plays out after he comes back from the mountain and is his sense of himself has been so shaken, and who he is and what he's capable of, it also changes his relationship with this with his boys and with his sense of, you know, is he a lunatic or a hero, right? That resonates. And he's still trying to figure that out. And then his relationship with those boys changes, and he's got to find his way in a particular way. And he needs them to help him.
Well, you know, why I think your book, Dixon Descending, is so important, Karen Newton, is that there is one major theme that I feel the book deals with more than anything else, which I think we also are always dealing with. And that is a difficult decision of making, you know, of making decisions. Okay.
Yes.
And then not feeling guilty about the decision that one makes. Mm-hmm. And just talk about that, because sometimes you're presented sometime in literature where if the person is making these decisions and having difficulty, there's some sort of religious framework, you know, like a church, or there's a choir scene or something like that, you know. I'm thinking like someone like, you know, Jimmy Baldwin, Go Tell on the Mountain, you know. Okay. You have that. But other than the spirituality that seems to come from climbing a mountain, I don't see this as a very spiritual book, but I do see this in terms of, okay, how do I make decisions, and can I live with the decisions that I make?
Yes. Yes. That's definitely something that I was thinking about a lot. How you live with those decisions, and especially decisions that show you in a light that is different than you want to be seen in, or who you think you were. How do you live with that choice? I wasn't sure what the answer was going to be when I started writing this, and I knew that that was really the core of the story. How do you live with it when the most audacious thing you can think of doing upends your life, and changes all of it? And so I think the choice to name the book Dixon Descending was about not just, descent from the mountain, but Dixon descending from his lofty ideas of himself. And that's really, one of the things I learned when I was researching about Mount Everest was that the majority of people die during descent because they're tired, the adrenaline is gone, and also I think the reality hits, oh my God, I'm at the top, but I didn't get all the way. Or you may not even be at the top. You may be somebody like some of my characters who has trouble with altitude sickness. You have no idea when that's whether that's going to hit you severely. And descending becomes really treacherous.
Well, when you talk about the things becoming treacherous, one gets a sense of that from your writing. So I wanted you to read about another entry, and this is about the base camp,
Yes.
because I feel that this is where we really see your research and your skill as a writer coming in.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Base camp encompassed a dingy, rocky perch that spread more than half a mile at the foot of Everest and resembled the pitted gray surface of the moon. Amid the dusty earth and car-sized boulders, a frontier town grew. Its clusters of electric blue and yellow tents spread low across the ridge, the colors dazzling in the sun so that Dixon had to squint. Electricity rose from the camp as Dixon entered. His every nerve ending at attention, he was here. Nate grabbed hold of him and shook him, laugh panting, utterly joyous. Dixon could not find words. He studied the landscape. Arranged in small groups by each expedition team, the tent clusters served as individual neighborhoods. Many buildings connected like a long yellow caterpillar with legs splayed out. A central dining tent connected to cooking, communications, sleeping, and gear tents. Prayer flags crisscross the roofs. They're blowing prayers up to mountain, carrying blessings down. Pemba, Dixon Sherpa explained. Satellite dishes sprang up throughout, and the camp resonated with song and laughter and loud conversation in various languages. It was a thrilling circus of a place. On their first night in this wonderland, amid the glow of the yellow tent that was now home, Dixon and Nate sat very close, their arms around their knees with elbows resting against each other. They were too new to this altitude to exert much physical effort, too dazzled as well. Most newcomers reclined in lounge chairs, drinking beer or wine from tin cups. Dixon remembered the old west of Saturday afternoon movies, the men around them on Everest like loungers outside the saloon. Those who hung at the periphery of the town were watchful as sheriffs. There was the unmistakable waft of marijuana. A gritty layer of dirt covered every surface. Except for the blare of TVs, videos, rock, rap, and blues spilling from tents, it could indeed be the set of a TV Western. Several Nepalese men wandered through camp, passing out flyers for a bed and breakfast just below base camp. The flyers promised good bed, clean towel. A native man approached. He was somewhere between 50 and 90. Depending on the way the lamplight illumined or shadowed his wrinkled skin, he raised his cloaked arm in the direction of several young women who posed on the edge of the makeshift city. Very clean, she is very clean, the man said. I heard about this craziness, but I can't believe it, Dixon said to Nate once the man had moved on. Brother, Nate said, we are in the hood.
You're listening to Karen Uten reading from her novel, Dixon Descending. Karen, back on June 11th in the New York Times, there was an article about the Sherpa. It was entitled, A Champion Sherpa Died Guiding Foreigners. And then the question, is it too dangerous? And they talked about how the Sherpa does the following. He lugs heavy packs of oxygen cylinders for foreign clients. He cooks and sets up camp. He navigates through snowstorms and clears piles of trash. He wakes before dawn and spends hours driving metal pickets into the snow so a rope line can protect foreign climbers. He drudges past icefalls where bus-sized slabs have buried other Sherpas in frozen graveyards. When you look at this, you know, I mean, you were able to write this novel from afar, you know, but you also have two Sherpas who are brothers, and I want to know how they contrast with Nate and Dixon.
Yeah, I once I discovered that, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. And I think that the Sherpa brothers feel a special responsibility toward Nate and Dixon, because they understand, you know, one of them says, we're carrying our families up to Everest. And their bond really informs how attentive they are to Nate and Dixon, and how they are invested in their success or failure, I think. And one of the things that I struggled with was I wanted, you know, there's so much to tell about Everest. There's so much to tell about the Sherpas and what their experience is and how we should feel about it. Because on one hand, there is this idea that maybe they're being exploited. On the other hand, because there's such poverty in Nepal, the Sherpa are actually supporting whole families. Right. You know, the difference between whether their children are educated and get to pay the school fees and go into Kathmandu to go to school, that difference is made on that mountain. And so I wanted to make sure that that was reflected, and I had to balance that, and had to have Nate and Dixon become aware of, you know, yes, we're allies with these Sherpa brothers, but also there's a big difference in our levels of privilege.
You know, I was curious as to, not giving the novel away, but it seems that the Sherpa brothers were maybe a little closer than even Nate and Dixon, because they seem to be that concern for each other, where someone could say that, you know, Dixon is putting Nate's at risk, you know. Mm-hmm. When do you go back and help your brother? And the ego, as you begin to talk about at the beginning, mm-hmm. is it more important for your own ego to, mm-hmm. you know, to get to the Olympics than anything else, as right. opposed to going back and saving, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I felt that, you know, one of the issues, one of the things Nate has to live with, I mean, I'm sorry, that Dixon has to live with, is the choices that he makes on the mountain, because they are so antithetical to the choices that he makes on the ground in real life. As I was researching, I noticed two things that happen to people on the mountain. One is summit fever. You know, you're paying $65,000, $70,000 to go up there as a client, you know, somebody who is not an alpinist who climbs all the time. So you think, I paid my money. I want to get this done. And you realize that you're so close. And being so close means that you're...
There's something very black about that. I paid my money.
That's right. That's right.
The mountain's going to have to come down to me.
That's right. I'm getting there. Come I'm on. Getting there. Exactly. And you're also, you realize you're so close. Now, so close could mean that you are still 5 hours away, but you might be able to see that summit. How can somebody tell you you can't get there? So you get summit fever.
Let me mention something. I just something. I sound like I'm Francis Press Welsing for a minute, but the mountain is white.
Right, it is. Right? It is.
White. You know, and I'm looking at how many black people come so close to that success. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe being the first this or the first that. Mm-hmm. And for many of the people who achieved that, there is that loneliness at the
yes.
top.
Yes.
You know? So talk
yes.
about that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Very much about what might it be like to be there. And even the first time I thought about it was when they're announcing to their friends and family, we're going to do this. And they're like, you got to be kidding. Who does this? Isn't your life hard enough on earth that you, you know, you have to go climb a mountain? And then one of the questions is, are you going to be the only ones? Will there be other people of color up there? How do you know what's going to happen? So I think all of those underlying questions about race, and the mountain, by the way, is black underneath. It's
I'm just snow messing with you.
It's the snow
we're
that's like
underneath all black.
That's plate.
They just don't want to tell us.
But yeah, I definitely thought about the idea of loneliness and standing out, and I think part of what Dixon experiences that is. What makes the descending so difficult for him is he sets himself apart from his brother in a way that he never has before. And there are consequences. You know, it's interesting because one of my cousins read the book and he called me up furious. And he says, I'm mad with you about Dixon. Dixon's a bum, blah, 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 blah. You know, all the things that you say happened in this, but that would never, you never do that. And then he called me a week or two later and he said, you know, I had a situation like this. I had a situation where I did something unthinkable with my brother and I have been feeling guilty forever. So I think that, you know, it for him, it, you know, there weren't catastrophic kinds of repercussions, but other than living with the guilt and living with the knowledge of who we could be.
Well, let's talk about not just the guilt, but I want to link this to you as a novelist. Talk about the loneliness of the novelist.
Wow. It is lonely because this is what ultimately helped me understand mountain climbing. When I was talking to the first climber that I interviewed, who was a pretty well-known guy, who's an alpinist, right? A real climber who does this readily and repeatedly, some of the rules that he told me about really blew me away. He said, you know, you climb for a good experience of the mountain. You're going up there with someone, you know you're going to do it again. So, you know, these alpinists are least likely to get summit fever because they're going with friends or with colleagues. Somebody gets in trouble, you turn around, you go down, but you know there's another mountain. And you also know that a third of the time, you're not going to reach the summit. And that's why you're there for this good experience. And so as a novelist, I think what I had to learn was how many times I wasn't going to get to the summit. And in fact, in revision, there would be so many layers and layers of revision. I felt more like a writer than I ever had because I understood, yeah, the drafting, the creating, that's all well and good. It's about the digging around and going back in there and fighting for the story and the story that the story wants to be, not necessarily what you want. And it is lonely. It is thankless. You don't know what's going to come out of it. And what I've sort of discovered over the years is that you have to make promises to yourself about what will be success for you. And that can't be external stuff. It can't be, oh, I've got to be on the bestseller list. No. What promises are you making to yourself about your writing that you will keep that will guide you?
Karen, you know, we have a few more minutes in our show, but there's something that you have here in your book. You provide a description of the body disposal preference form.
Yeah.
You know, with what happens at a different altitude. And I was thinking in terms of what we see happening over in Gaza and Israel, where for many communities, you have to have a body. You know, I remember even after 9/11, but people say, okay, there's no closure until I have something, you know. And I'm learning like how with somebody who maybe say is Jewish climbing a mountain, you're just gonna leave a body there? And you know what I mean? I can see a community getting together and say, no, we're gonna go get the body, you know, because it just seems that, you know, that decision just to leave somebody there. Maybe it's very Eastern where, you know, you sort of make this dedication in front of the temple or whatever, and you can leave somebody there. But for, I know for, but for some groups and religious beliefs, you have to have, you take that, bring that body back. Or you take, for example, the Marine Code, we leave nobody behind.
Exactly. Well, and that was one of the things that was most stunning to me in looking at sort of the packets that you of all the information that you fill out. I'm telling you, if I had had any idea of climbing Mount Everest and I got a packet from an expedition that said body disposal form, what would you like us to do with
Isn't
your
that,
body?
but
Because
isn't that
we
what you
can't
get from
bring
historic?
it.
Isn't that what you get with your mission package from historic black colleges? If you don't graduate, you fill out this form, and your mother comes and gets you.
That's hilarious.
But before we had, I have just a few minutes. Briefly talk about two other men that are very important. That's Skeet and Herbert.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and we only have a few more minutes, so if I can.
Okay. Skeet is Dixon's is Nate's best friend, but he's also Dixon's friend in a way that Dixon, I don't think, has acknowledged before. He's a hanger-on and he assumes, like everyone else, that he's an acolyte of Nate. You know, you must be here because of Nate. But he's also there for Dixon, and he represents, I think, in many ways, the larger community and what the stakes are for other people in
I thought
that.
I thought he was Jay-Z for a minute. Just that's how I was
That's
reading.
funny. That's funny. Well, he represents, I think, for me, the larger community in that he's like, okay, you're doing this for us. This is making a name for us. And then he has to come to terms with what happens also. Herbert, I think, is sort of my spirit animal. I love Herbert because I think he becomes a guide for Dixon as Dixon moves into the unknown territory of a man who has been broken or who has failed. And Herbert is somebody who's been there and come back, and he can guide him.
You know, the last question, Karen, which I think is a very important question. This took a tremendous amount of research. You mentioned all the books and films and things that you want. What was your day like? Because, you know, you had a job. I mean, did you carve out, did you know, we before the program, we were talking about going to these residencies. Did you carve, what was your process?
You know, it changed over the course of the 15 years. You know, when I was younger, I would go to work, come home 6 o'clock or so, eat dinner, go to bed, get up about 9 and work until 2 because I'm a night owl. Binge on weekends, that kind of thing. But one of the things I'm not great about is discipline, I have to tell you. And I do like to have unfettered space. So there was so much trial and error. Can I do this an hour at a time? Can I do this a couple of hours at a time? And it differed. It was much easier to take short periods of time to edit. But in the writing, I really needed that downtime. And in fact, for the Everest pieces, I needed to go away. I needed to go away and be completely immersed in this, so much so that I would come out of my writing retreat place at Hedgebrook and be surprised there was no snow.
Well, you brought down, I know down in Louisiana when I have commandments in the schools now, but you seem like you brought something from that from the mountain down
Thank
to us. And we those of us who are worshiping the calf while you were ascending, we now can go back and be good people. But I want to, Karen Uten, I want to thank you for being my guest on the margin. My guest today has been Karen Uten. She's the author of Dixon Descending, a book that you can publish from obtain from Dutton Publishers Company. And my name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's on the margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let me.
Recording stopped.
Okay, so what I'll
that was wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much. Right. I so appreciate
okay.
it.
What I'll do is send you a link to the program. Okay.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
All right. Okay.
And if you hear it all from Andy Shalal, or if you want to contact connect us, I will love that.
Okay, yeah. I'll do that before I leave. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so all much. Right. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it too.
Me all too.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
All right.
Robin Holden. On Sunday, July 7th, from 4 until 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, and reggae at Mango Cafe.